Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Winter birding doesn't always get its due, but they're out there. So joining us today by phone to talk about how to get the most from a winter birding experience and other winter outdoor naturalist activities is naturalist artist, author, and blogger Julie Zicafoos. Welcome back, Julie.
Well, howdy do, Ann.
What's your favorite part about winter in nature?
Yeah, you know, I'm kind of a silence junkie, so to me, getting in the middle of the woods and hearing nothing is just so fabulous. I love that. And then the things that you do hear kind of jump out at you, like a downy woodpecker tapping or maybe a single jay call or something like that. So, yeah, I think, I don't know, the older I get, the more sounds mean to me. And like in late summer, insect music just, I just go into raptures at the insect music. And in the winter, I kind of appreciate the absence of all that. It's kind of the space in between the things, you know?
For me, you know, I'm not good at hearing what's going on out there. And I've gone with you on walks, and I know that you can hear just a jumble, a cacophony out there, and you can pick things out.
Mm-hmm.
We'll even listen to bird sounds on the radio, and you'll be able to hear something in the background. You freak me out. But in the winter, I can hear things better. I mean, that's when I finally figured out what a cardinal sounded like was in the winter.
Yeah, because you're getting basically individual songsters or callers, and you can get your binoculars on them and track them down and see who's making that noise. That's really fun.
Yeah, that's the other part is you can see them more easily.
Right, right. No foliage, and there they are. And, you know, I will confess, I do really enjoy putting out many, many pounds of seed per day and watching what comes into the yard. Like right now, right in front of me, I've got a beautiful male eastern towhee, the old name rufous-sided towhee. I've got some starlings. I've got a red-bellied woodpecker. I've got about 16 cardinals. It's just, oh, man. Getting these things in and having them right in front of you against a white backdrop, it doesn't get a lot better than that.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. My guest this hour is Julie Zicafoos, naturalist, artist, author, and blogger. If you have a question or comment about nature in the winter, give us a call, 614-292-8513. Now, obviously, the number of birds roaming around Ohio, and it varies by region in Ohio very much, changes a lot in the winter, right?
Yeah, we lose all the insectivores almost, and what the ones who stay are the ones who can live on seeds and fruits that are they find in the woods. And so, although yesterday we had a yellow-rumped warbler picking up the suet here, and so you know if you keep food out, you're going to get some stragglers who probably shouldn't be around, you know, who might come in for offering such a suet or maybe the famous Zic dough that I make.
Yeah, we're going to talk about that later on.
Yeah.
I don't know about you, but the fall here was fabulous.
Just on and on.
It was absolutely fabulous.
Oh, it was great.
But I wondered, did it confuse or does it confuse some of those stragglers about where they should be going at what time?
Well, bird migrants sort of fall into two groups. The first group are obligate migrants. Obligate migrants basically respond to day length as opposed to temperature, really.
Okay.
And so the obligate migrants are going to go in September, no matter if we have another 2 months of fabulous, beautiful fall coming or not. Those are the birds for whom the curtain falls at the first frost, you know, and they can't find their food when all the insects croak. So basically, obligate migrants are going to go no matter what. Facultative migrants are birds like robins and bluebirds. Some of the woodpeckers, don't move much unless they absolutely have to. So facultative migrants like robins and bluebirds will move only as far south as they need to find food. So their migrations are quite erratic and unpredictable. And, you know, there have been robins around here. You know, these are birds who are kind of respond more to temperature, storms, ice, that kind of thing, and who go, uh-oh, we better pack up, you know. I think if I were a bird, I would be a facultative migrant. I would say, what a fabulous fall. I'm going to roll around in this for a while, you know. And boy, did I. Wasn't that the best fall ever?
Yeah, it really, really was.
Yeah.
I still can't get over it because, you know, it got real cold, and I've been complaining. I just can't handle this up and down thing that we're going to be going through again this week.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, I guess I'm grateful for I'm grateful for any temperatures above freezing because I like to be out every day if possible. And so when I don't have to wear gloves and I can shoot pictures with my smartphone, you know, without gloves, I'm a happy girl.
Are there temperatures that, I mean, do birds, are they, do they react to the cold, though? I mean, are there, can the cold hurt them at some point?
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. And, you know, there have been a bunch of studies that have shown that birds that visit feeders have a higher survival rate over the winter. You know, basically it's all about, can I find enough food to burn enough calories to keep, to fend this cold off? Yesterday we were watching birds under the feeder and they were puffed out to the max. You know, they were just like these little puffballs. And what they're doing is basically layering. They're trying to trap as much air in their plumage as possible to, you know, to ward off the cold. So that's how they do it. They just puff out more, and you'll see them sitting down on their little feet to keep those warm, and you know, taking shelter in evergreens. That's, you know, I'm a flower freak, so I kind of begrudge any room that I give in my gardens to shrubs. But shrubs are so important this time of year, as are the thick spruces and firs that we sometimes plant in our yards. They're just full of birds right now.
Right.
Yeah.
Let's listen to some bird.
Mm.
This is the spring song of white-breasted nuthatch, and it's one of the first birds, you say, to begin singing in January. Let's listen to it first. Well, that's a good recording. Is it the right one?
Oh, it's great.
Okay.
Yeah, that, I know you're always going to be gun shy around me. I'm such a tyrant. Yeah, that's a beautiful recording of a spring song of a white-breasted nuthatch. And I guess I picked that because not a lot of people would hear that as a song. But for some of these birds with sort of more primitive vocal structures like nuthatches, that's a full-blown aria right there. That meep, 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 meep. And I love it because, to me, it's a song of hope. It says that the nuthatch is feeling it, you know. It says that the nuthatch knows that the days are getting longer and spring is coming. And that you can hear that in January is just, I just find very charming. I also just happen to absolutely adore nuthatches. They're super smart, funny, cool little birds.
They're cute.
Yeah, they're not only cute, they're just very inventive. Like, I had a nuthatch in rehab once who... it was clear to me was becoming depressed. He had been bitten by a cat, and he didn't have any broken bones, but he needed time to recover. So I gave him antibiotics and time, and I noticed he was getting depressed, and I thought, you're bored.
What does a nuthatch do when it's depressed? How
well,
do you know that?
Well, it doesn't eat as much. It just sits there. It mopes. It stops preening. It's like, you know, like we are. You know, we don't go brush our hair. We just let it be a mess.
Mm-hmm.
So what I did was I put him in a really big, like a cockatiel cage, and I moved him into my studio where he could watch me work. And then I gave him logs with a lot of flaky bark on them, and I gave him sunflower seeds, and he filled those logs with sunflower seeds. He put them in all the crevices, and he got himself busy cracking them open, and he just brightened in every way, and he needed something to do. And he recovered and was released in my yard. That was nice.
Yeah, because I guess you got to think about it. You take a bird out of circulation like that, they're used to spending their whole day just getting those calories, et cetera, et cetera.
Right, right. Birds are busy all the time. They don't do much fooling around or sitting there, you know. And they do tend to get bored. I had a ruddy turnstone once when I was doing rehab in Connecticut, and it's a shorebird. And same thing. The bird was just moping. So I thought, well, you know, maybe I shouldn't give you your food just in a dish here. Maybe I should hide it. So I put a bunch of rocks in his pen and hid all his food under the rocks. So he was busy all day flipping those things. And it just made him feel better. You know, it was more like what he should have been doing. And he also was released too.
And Julie, you are, by the way, we should note, an authorized, certified...
Permitted.
Permitted, that's
yeah.
it.
Yeah, wildlife rehabilitator. Yep, I've got state and federal permits to carry on this activity. I'm not super active. Most of the stuff I get, I wind up referring right to the Ohio Wildlife Center in mm-hmm. Columbus, which needs your help, support, and donations. But occasionally I'm going to be home and I can raise something or I can take something in to help it. And I get so much from that. It's wonderful.
Cats are a big problem.
Cats are a huge problem, yeah. About 90% of the songbirds I get are cat problems. You know, they've been brought down by a cat. So, yeah. If anybody wants to read more on that, there's a new book by Peter Mara and Chris Santella called Cat Wars, The Devastating Consequences of a Cuddly Killer. And it's been a real game changer, I think, reading that and realizing the enormity of the loose cat problem as regards our bird populations.
You're not down on cats either. It's not like you dislike them personally.
I love them. I mean, yeah. I'm the first one to go up and, you know, snuggle the little kitty on the sofa. I love them indoors. I can't deal with them outside. Yeah, they don't belong out.
How many species of birds, I mean, you know, ballpark, reside in Ohio during the winter?
Oh, boy. I'd have to Google that. You got me, Ann.
I think I already did Google it.
Did you really?
Well, I mean, it goes down from something like 340 or something down to maybe just 20 or 30.
Because, oh, no, there's more than that.
Well, because that I was going to say, when I did Google it, that was in Northeast Ohio. And the state as a whole is very, like I said, is very different. There's lots of different sections of the state.
Yeah, you got to roll in all the waterfowl. You got to roll in the raptors, you know. I would think that maybe our numbers are cut in half. This is where my friend Jim McCormick would be so awesome. He would say, there are 136 species of resident. <Yeah. laughs> And I'm just not that person. I'm an artist.
Recently retired from the Ohio Department of Natural Resources.
Exactly.
Yeah, we've tried to get him on. We haven't had any luck, but we will continue.
Oh, you need to. He's brilliant.
I read his column often in the Columbus Dispatch.
Mm-hmm.
So, Ohio is one of those kind of states that has lots of different systems.
Oh, yeah, lots of different ecosystems and a bunch of bird variety as for it. You know, I think I feel so blessed to live in the Appalachian Southeast Ohio, which is very rumpled. It's got a lot of relief in the land and topography, and so we have high diversity in the forests and, you know, plant diversity. And anywhere you have high plant diversity, you're going to have high bird diversity as well. So we have a fabulous conjunction of breeding species. Like on our place, which is just a small 80-acre sanctuary northeast of Marietta, I have recorded 13 different breeding species of warblers alone on our land, and not all present in any one year, but that's a lot of birds. That's a lot of warblers. And representatives from the southern ecosystems as well as the northern. So we'll have birds like cerulean warblers and hooded warblers and American redstarts and worm-eating warblers. You know, real prizes, things that people will travel to come see.
We will continue our conversation about winter birding, winter nature, with naturalist, artist, author, and blogger Julie Zicafus. If you have questions or comments, give us a call, 614-292-8513. You can email us at allsides@wosu.org. And by the way, as many as 150 bird species may be found in Ohio during January. Thank you, Michael DeBonis. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Winter is often overlooked as a season for birding. Migration and breeding are on hold, of course, but there is still lots to see and hear. Joining us by phone is author, artist, and natural historian Julie Zicafus. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Let's listen to some sound, Julie Zicafus.
All right.
The winter wren calls and songs. It's an uncommon winter migrant. Let's listen. So for the winter wren, Ohio is sort of like their getaway in the winter.
It is, yeah. This is a bird that breeds in farther north, you know, often montane regions up into New England and Canada and maybe the northern tier of Ohio. And I was intrigued to hear running water in that recording, and of course just the little bip bip call of the wren. And I think I love these guys. I just ran into one 2 days ago because we only get them in the depths of winter, usually January, and they haunt root tangles. This is their thing. They like to nest in the windthrow mounds created by trees when all the roots are exposed, and there's that wonderful jumble of dirt and roots and little crevices and crannies. So they nest in there, and but in the winter, they also seek out that kind of habitat, and so they love exposed roots along stream sides, and that's where I saw my little guy. Do you happen to have a recording of the song?
No, we don't.
Okay.
What we just heard was a call?
That was a call. And you find them, it sounds just like a song sparrow's call, except that it's doubled. So that's the kind of thing I love the most, is the subtle stuff, you know, where you go, oh, I know what I'm hearing. And then you kind of hunt it down.
What's the difference between a call and a song?
A call is usually short, and it's used to ascertain a bird's location, you know, like, bip, I'm here, chip, I'm here. Mm-hmm. And like, for instance, a baby bird that's sitting in a bush will give a little beep, 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 you know, or beep, beep. That's a location call. A song has a different intent. A song is more of a proclamation of territory, of readiness to breed, and it's usually more complex and longer and, you know, comes from sort of a different place in the bird's needs.
Is there anything that we know about birds that suggests they do it for the fun of it?
Well, anytime I watch a mockingbird, I am pretty sure that they enjoy singing because, you know, they sing so much, and they sing in the middle of the night, and they have a display where they'll be in the middle of a song, and they'll leap into the air and then tumble down back to the perch where they started. And I know it's probably to show off their white wing and tail patches, but there just seems to be so much joy in it. I had caged birds for years that, you know, cat-injured birds that lived in my studio, an orchard oriole and a Savannah sparrow. And they sang for much of every day. They certainly had no territory to proclaim. They seemed to sing to pass the time and sometimes for pleasure, too. So I think we shouldn't rule out that possibility.
You know, the more I learn about birds from talking with you and others, the more I realize so much of it's still a mystery.
Well, you know, my whole thrust in my writing is emphasizing the emotional capabilities and capacities of animals and birds. And I like to advocate for birds because so many people view them as automatons, you know, little feathered automatons. Somebody just sent me a YouTube video of a baby emu, and it was in somebody's living room, and this old Labrador retriever walks into the room, and the emu just goes into transports of what looks like joy upon seeing its friend. It jumps straight up into the air. It flops down on its side. It rolls around on its back. It jumps back up, and it's just like, it's the cutest thing, because this bird is obviously just like so excited to see this dog. Now, whether it's something primitive like, oh, that looks like a predator, I should probably kick it, you know, maybe some of that was going on, but it seemed to me that it knew the dog and it was very, very happy to see it. So certainly when I act as a bird's foster mom, when I raise them, I get keyed into all the stuff that's going on in their heads, and I can tell you there's bonding and there's affection and there's love. It's just there.
Let's talk about Feed the Zick Doe.
Oh, yeah.
It was referenced recently I think, the Detroit Free Press talking about it, your winner. your winner recipe. Tell us about it.
Well, it's something that I have borrowed from others. I didn't invent it by any means, but what I did do is tweak it. The original recipe called for a mixture of peanut butter, lard, cornmeal, rolled quick oats, and flour. And I fed that for a number of years, and I noticed that it produced health problems in birds that ate a lot of it. And you kind of have to be looking closely to pick this out, but I had a perfect test subject in the bluebirds that live on my place. Bluebirds are addictive personalities. if they were a person, they would be the junkies on the street corner. Mm. And a bluebird will fixate on a food source, an artificial food source like this dough, and they will eat it to excess. They will eat it to the exclusion of other things. And I noticed that my birds were developing gout in their feet. They were showing pain and swelling in their feet. So I checked it out with my avian veterinarian, Bob Giddings, who is in Connecticut and who I still talk with by phone. And he said, yeah, birds can get gout. And it's probably the purines in the lard that is doing it. So I modified the recipe to include, rather than just cornmeal and rolled oats, chick starter, which is a highly nutritious extruded pellet form of food for growing chicks. It's got all kinds of vitamins and minerals and protein. And so I mix that now with the peanut butter and a little bit of lard and the flour and cornmeal. And I make this loose, crumbly stuff that birds just absolutely adore. It's like crack. And so I'm careful, and I put out just a little bit every day. And I put it, I don't want the starlings to just gobble it down, so I put it in what I call my snob feeder, which is hanging right in front of the kitchen sink where I can scare anything away that I don't want eating that. So it's a little dome feeder that hangs there. And so it's really kind of limited to the birds that know about it. It's like our little speakeasy, you know, they come to my kitchen windowsill for this stuff, and I got this stuff. So if you want to know how to make it, all you have to do is Google Zick Dough Improved.
Okay.
Yeah.
Google Zick Dough Improved. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. My guest is Julie Zickafoos, naturalist, artist, author, blogger, and one of our favorite guests on All Sides with Ann Fisher. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. And Barb and Gahanna, you have a question for Julie about bird feeding.
I do. It's probably more of a summertime question and a comment, but we had a problem in our yard this spring and summer with skunks. I mean, a horrible problem. They were spraying the neighbor's dogs through the fence. We had wild cats running around that were being sprayed. Our yard stunk. So I called someone who catches them, and he came and said, "It's your bird feeders that are attracting them." And I was skeptical at first and said, "Oh, I don't think so." And he said, "Oh, yeah, I know so." So he put down the little cages that he uses to collect them under three of my bird feeders. And within 2 days, we had all three of the traps or the cages occupied by skunks.
Oh, yeah.
So very sadly, I took down all of my bird feeders, and I think I'm suffering from withdrawal.
Aww.
Because I love having my birds in the yard.
Understood.
Wondering what I can do to alleviate that problem. And I'm not the only one. I had a neighbor down the road who had five of them that he got in his yard.
Okay.
So.
Okay, well, let's think a little bit about the natural history of skunks. One of the beautiful things about skunks is they sleep all winter. So you can feel free to put your feeders back up, and they should not bother you in the winter. They don't properly hibernate. They more sleep the way raccoons do. And I, in fact, just found the tracks of a skunk going through the snow. But mostly what they're doing this time in January, around the January thaw, is they're just kind of looking for another burrow to sleep in for a while. So winter feeding, okay around skunks. The other thing that you might keep in mind is that the skunks may not necessarily be attracted to the seed that's falling, although they are omnivores. Skunks are more into insects and small rodents. Hmm. And so what they're probably doing is digging around under your feeders and finding the things that are attracted to the seeds, like voles, mice, and grubs and things in the soil. I happen to adore skunks, and I've been, you know, guilty of encouraging them, actually. But I understand completely what it must be like to live where you're hearing, smelling, spraying every night. That can't be any fun.
No. All right, Barb, thanks for that. That's a we have never gotten that question before.
I love it.
Okay. And then Kevin has another feeding question. Hi, Kevin, you're on the air.
Hello. My question is, I have a bird feeder out back, and obviously at this time of year it gets frozen. I looked into getting one of those bird feeder heaters, and I'll be out about $100 for something like that. So is that worthwhile, or will the birds find water on their own? They don't really need it.
Okay, you said you had a bird feeder that gets frozen. I think you mean you have a bird bath that gets frozen.
Oh, bird
right?
bath, yes.
Yeah, let me give you an easy, quick, very cheap alternative. On my blog, Julie Zicafus on Blogspot, I did a post called The Best Thing I've Ever Bought. You can Google that. And it was a $20 heated dog dish, which you can get at any outdoor tractor supply, feed store, a good hardware store. Some pet stores even stock them. Mine is green. It's rather homely. It has a cord. You plug it in, and it will keep water unfrozen even in the single digits.
Where do you put it?
I put it up on a little pedestal. I have it on an overturned planter in my yard right near the feeder. And the beauty of this thing is it only holds a couple of gallons of water, and so you can clean it very easily. And I stress, you've got to clean these things, even in the winter when it's nasty, because birds will inevitably, you know, poop into the water. So I clean mine religiously every 2 days, no matter what, and I refill it with fresh water. Make sure you refill it with fresh cold water, not warm, because that'll mess up your thermostat. But it's like a $20, $25 thing. It's a heated outdoor dog dish, and it is the bomb because I've just got birds at it all the time. The other thing that I do is I put large flat rocks in it so that the birds have something to stand on in the middle. They do not bathe in it usually. They're just drinking from it.
In the winter.
Correct.
Yeah,
the only birds crazy enough to bathe in the dead of winter are starlings. I don't know why, but they will do it. So the rocks kind of help keep them, you know, from wanting to bathe in it too much. I don't want starlings bathing in my bird bath. They're dirty birds.
Kevin, thanks a lot for that call. And I wanted to listen to some more sounds. We have the yellow-bellied sapsucker squealing, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Let's listen to that.
Isn't that great?
Yeah, that is pretty cool.
Yeah. This is another one, like the winter wren, which only really comes into Ohio in the winter. And we don't really get them breeding very much in Ohio, probably the northeast and northwest sector. We might get some yellow-bellied sapsuckers breeding. But generally, this is a migrant to Ohio. And I love them because, just like the winter wren, I find them by that funny little sound. And it's like a little cat squealing in the middle of the woods. And then the fun becomes picking it out, sort of doing a Where's Waldo thing, looking for this thing on the trunk of a tree. Sapsuckers are drilling what we call sap wells in the trunks of trees, little rows of round holes, and they visit these sap wells regularly during the day. And what they'll do is they'll drill a bunch of different trees, and they have sort of a trap line that they visit all day long. And the neat thing about that is that other birds know about these wells and will go visit them. Kinglets will come, the warblers will come in the spring, and lots of birds visit the wells for the insects that are attracted to the running sap, the sugar there.
Is so that just, what is called drumming?
No, the drumming okay. Drumming is actually a display like woodpeckers do on your gutter in the spring.
Oh, okay.
You know.
Gotcha.
So the sapsuckers have a very distinctive drum. It's like tuck-tuck-tuck-tuck-tuck-tuck-tuck. It's very irregular. They're the only woodpecker with an irregular drum that we hear around here. So, yeah, I didn't know if you had a recording of that. But
no, we don't. So
well, you don't hear it in the winter anyway. It's okay. Really a breeding area thing.
Okay.
Yeah.
Let's see. We got a couple of hot questions. Let's see. Charles and Ostrander, you're on the air. Hi, Charles.
Hi. So we live on an 80-acre farm and have a resident red-tailed hawk, or a pair of hawks. And I'm just wondering, it seems to me that when they raise their young, that they stay with them all the way till late fall, and then the adults leave. It seems like they disappear and leave the young behind. And I'm wondering if this is a strategy to give the young ones a chance to be on their own in a safe territory, because then in sometime early winter, the adults come back, And I wonder if at that point in time, they chase the young one out to send him out on his own.
You know, that's a really neat theory. I don't know that it could be substantiated unless you did a very, very detailed banding study of these things, because I would agree that you tend to see immature red-tailed hawks in the winter. But whether those are actually the sons and daughters of your residents would be very difficult to establish. If you've got a bird who frequents a certain perch at a certain time and you know for sure, that's great, you know, that's the same bird. But when you really start looking at it, what birds are actually doing in terms of juvenile dispersal and migration is often a lot more complex than it appears. I do know that red tails will migrate. They do seem to do a push south in October, but many of them stay, too. And I have the feeling that the red tails I see here in the winter, the adults, are the same ones that breed here in the summer, spring and summer. But I don't know that for sure. So that's a question I'd love to be able to answer or pontificate about, but I just can't because I'm not sure that the banding studies exist to support it. In one example, I took in a red-tailed hawk that was injured and got it to the Ohio Wildlife Center, and they rehabilitated it and returned it to me. The bird was, I think, 10 years old, and it was 350 miles from where it had been banded along the Kittatinny Ridge in Pennsylvania. So we really don't know a lot of the times what these things are doing, you know. Why? And as it turned out, this was the farthest band return that this bander had ever had in decades of banding red-tailed hawks, this bird 350 miles from where it had hatched. So that isn't a very good answer, I know, but I like your theory.
I think it's a good answer, Charles. Thanks for that call. Appreciate it. We will continue our conversation with Julie Zicafus, naturalist, artist, author, and blogger. When we return, if you have questions or comments, we welcome them, 614-292-8513. You can email us at allsides@wosu.org or check out our Facebook page, post your question or comment there. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking about winter birds. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. My guest is Julie Zicafus, naturalist, artist, author, and blogger. Julie, we have a question from Martha. It's an email. She says, I recently moved my bird feeder to a more convenient place for filling during the winter months and have noticed the birds have not followed the feeder. It is between the houses now. Does this mean they just can't find it, or has the large number of crows chased all the smaller birds away?
Well, crows are often vilified for doing all kinds of bad things, but I don't think that crows are able to chase birds away from a feeder that they really want to visit. I feed my crows corn off to the side. I adore crows. That said, it sounds as though you may have relocated your feeder to a spot between houses where birds do not feel comfortable coming.
Hmm.
Birds like to have clear, open sight lines around their feeders. They don't want to be down in between a couple of structures where something could pop over the roof line and surprise them. And when I say something, I'm talking about a sharp-shinned or a Cooper's hawk who like to surprise birds. They'll come around the corner of a house and chase everybody, and some of the birds will hit a window and they'll pick them up under the window. They get very, very smart about hunting like that. So my suggestion would be to find some compromise where it's still easy for you to reach, but the birds can see all around them. Don't ask them to come in between two houses if the space is rather narrow.
Okay. And Dan in Poland, you have a question about losing birds to hawks. Welcome, Dan.
Hi. Yes. We had also relocated our feeders for winter, but I've had hawk, I don't know if it's the same one, but I've had hawks take a couple of birds. Mm-hmm. And then the other day I looked out and there was a crow eating a red bird, a cardinal that had was on the ground. Now, I don't know if he had killed it or if he had just found it there. Maybe it was scared by a hawk, like the lady said previously. But I feel kind of guilty about putting the feeders up and then the birds succumbing to the hawk. Any suggestions?
Well, I guess I'd ask you to take a larger view of what's going on here. First off, I'm going to defend crows again. It's very rare for crows to actually attack and kill healthy birds. If you have a window that cardinal may have flown into, that's probably more likely a scavenging situation on the crow's part. As far as the hawks, the larger view I'm asking you to take is anytime we artificially invite a conflagration of birds, like right now I'm probably looking at 100 individuals under my feeders. Anytime we do that, we are inviting predators, because why wouldn't you go where it's crowded and full of food? So I think that I tend to look at hawks as a natural part of this system, as a check and a balance to overpopulation. I agree. There is an element of guilt where you feel that you've created this concentration of birds, and thus you've created a buffet for the hawk. But hawks got to eat too. And I actually love to have a hawk come to my feeder, because there are a lot fewer of them than there are cardinals and goldfinches and juncos, and they'll often take a starling, which is a plus.
But of course, going back to the thing is, if you don't necessarily want to move the feeder between houses or something like that, where you're inviting.
Yeah, where you don't want to set it up into a situation where, like, if you notice that the hawk has learned to spook everybody off the feeder toward the window, and they're all hitting the window several times a day, you know, that's a problem. And you need to either treat the window to keep that from happening, and by that I mean put crop netting up in front of the window, which is what I do, or you need to relocate the feeder so that there's not that option doesn't present itself to the hawk. They're smart.
Dan, thanks a lot for that call. Email from Peter says, I use the railing of my balcony to spread wild bird and also food scraps such as brown rice and bread crusts, which I pan fry in canola oil, as I figure they need the calories in this very cold weather. My question, is there any human food they should not be given?
I guess I would question offering bread to birds at all. Bread is not a very nutrient-dense food. And in extreme situations where people have been, say, feeding waterfowl nothing but white bread, you can see actual deformities. There's a deformity called angel wing that goslings and ducklings will display, where they have actually a deformed wing and are never able to fly because they have been hatched from eggs that were nutrient poor because their moms were fed bread. So bread is not something that would attract a lot besides starlings and house sparrows, and these are exotic birds that we don't necessarily want to foster. I'd encourage you to offer things other than bread. And rice, I would say, kind of falls into that category too. Encourage you to offer nuts in a nut feeder, peanuts, shelled peanuts in a nut feeder, which is like a hardware cloth cylinder. Offer black oil sunflower seed, offer suet in cages, more nutrient-dense foods that will help them get through the winter better.
Let's see. How about a little sound before we turn to some calls? This is the Blue Jay calls. Let's hear that. Now, these are Canadian blue jays, right?
Well, what's interesting, and again, you know, the studies are ongoing to try to figure out what blue jays do. But what seems to be happening with our winter blue jay populations is our summer blue jays that breed with us move south for the winter. They go down maybe along the Gulf Coast, Texas, Louisiana, that kind of thing. What we get in our area now is Canadian birds who come down to Ohio and go, wow, this feels like the tropics. So we seem to get a sort of a replacement of our birds with birds from way farther north. And I'm intrigued by that whole idea. I know that that the birds, the blue jays that we get in the winter, are different from the summer blue jays, because for three winters running, I had a bird who I named Peg, who had one leg that dangled useless. And I know it's terrible. Isn't it? My names are often not PC. And they, this bird was just, I just adored her. And she had a terrible time surviving. But 3 winters, this bird was with me. So she loved the dog dish bird bath, and she would drink at it. And I put out special foods, sunflower hearts for her, because she couldn't hammer the nut, the seeds open. So I gave her Zik dough and sunflower hearts, and she knew to come to a certain place where I would give her this stuff. We had a real relationship. But Peg always disappeared in the spring, and she would go farther north and presumably breed and then come back for the winter. So that was my little informal non-banding experiment. But, yeah, what we have here is probably blue jays from way up north, and I love them. I absolutely love them. I'm advocating for a lot of birds like Cooper's hawks and sharp-tailed hawks and blue jays that I know a lot of people consider pests or nuisances, because I want us to stop and appreciate the fact that as a common bird, we have a blue jay, which is one of the most spectacularly colorful,
completely
bold,
agree,
gorgeous,
yeah,
gorgeous bird. Please look at them with new eyes.
Oh, I love blue jays. I love what they look like. I completely agree.
I will buy corn for those things till the cows come home. Now, I have a neighbor who shall remain unnamed who brags about shooting them off the feeder because he claims they scare all the other birds away. Okay, blue jays have figured out how to give the call of a red-shouldered hawk or a red-tailed hawk and frighten other birds. I happen to value that. I think that's awesome. So when they come in, you know, yelling like a red-shouldered hawk, I think it's hilarious. So, you know, just enjoy them for what they are. Love them for what they are.
Stephen in Pataskala, you're on the air with Julie Zikafoos. Hi, Stephen.
Yes, we had a, hi, good morning. We had a couple of unusual black birds, a little bigger than a junco, not rotund, but a fairly rounder. The male had a whitish bib, and I don't know if you recognize from that description, but they were a coupled pair, apparently. There was a female that was kind of non-distinct, and the male had this white bib.
That's so interesting that you should say that, Stephen, because yesterday, do you know a starling when you see one?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Oh,
okay,
yeah.
So they weren't
black
starlings?
Bird.
They
no,
weren't starlings?
No.
Okay.
Nope.
Okay, because we had a starling show up yesterday with a white bib. And it was a partial albino. And it was like, what? It was the coolest looking bird. So I was just kind of flashing on that and thinking, whoa, this is wild. The white bib, have you tried rusty blackbird? Or have you looked at rusty blackbird in the field guide?
No, I'll check that out.
Check that out. Now, the white bib doesn't really fit for that, but they often have markings around the face. How bright white was this bib?
Not very.
Okay, so it was
pale,
a pale.
Yeah.
It was a pale area.
Colorated.
Okay,
yeah.
Try that. The other thing that's showing up at feeders right now are brown-headed cowbirds, and the female shows is an overall sort of a dark gray with a paler throat. So that would be another bird to check out.
Okay.
Yeah, check out rusty blackbird and brown-headed cowbird and see if you find your bird.
All right. Stephen, thanks a lot for that call. Gary in Cincinnati, you're on the air. Hi, Gary.
Hi, Ann. Love your show.
Thank you.
Got a question for Julie. Is there any way of keeping starlings away from feeders?
Yeah, there are a lot of ways. I mentioned earlier in the show my snob feeder, and that is a little plexiglass dome feeder. So it has a dome that covers a dish, and you can adjust how high the dish is beneath the dome. So it has a little wing nut. So if you have starling problems, you can bring that dome way down so that the starlings can't fit under there. So I would recommend going to, like, your local wild bird supply store and asking for a dome feeder with an adjustable dome. That's one way. Starlings aren't really crazy about having to hover and cling to stuff, although they will do it when the ground freezes up and they're starving. The other feeder design that discourages starlings is something called an Elizabethan cage, which sounds like a lot of fun, actually. But it's a it's just a feeder that's in the middle of a cage with wire spacing around it that will not admit starlings. So it's like a normal tube feeder, but it's surrounded by this cage. And so the chickadees and titmice can slip in and out, and the starlings can.
Oh, that's what that's for. Okay,
yeah.
I've seen those, yeah.
Yeah, and the other thing to keep in mind is that starlings are only a problem when the ground is frozen hard. And the thing I like about starlings is as soon as they can make their own living by probing in the ground for grubs, they will leave. You know, they only come to feeders when they're really in extremis. And I'm looking at like five of them underneath my suet feeder right now, picking away at it. And you know what? Okay.
I know
they'll be gone. Yeah, right. They'll be gone when it warms up again.
Thank you, Gary, for that call. Appreciate it. And let's see, Fred. Fred, where are you?
I'm in Ravenna.
Ravenna. Gotcha. Okay, good. Go ahead. Fred, are you there?
Yes.
Okay, go ahead.
I have a question, more so an observation. I put peanuts out for blue jays, and I've noticed that they're real selective. They'll go and pick several of them up to find the heaviest one and then select that one. Is this a conscious thing that they're doing, or are they that smart?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. Well, first off, you're talking about a corvid, and that is in the crow and jay family and the raven family, which are famous for brains. But chickadees do it too, titmice do it too, nuthatches do it too. If you watch a bird at your feeder, you can watch them weighing the seeds, discarding the ones that feel light to them, and going away with the heaviest one. It's definitely a conscious selection, and it's been borne out by controlled experiments.
That's what they're doing.
That's what they're doing. That's why you'll think, well, you just took a seed and you threw it away. What the heck?
Yeah.
No, they don't want to waste their time flying away with a seed that doesn't have the maximum meat in it. It's just like you at the grocery store where you pick the grapefruit that's heavy for its size, right?
Wow.
So that's the one that's packed with juice.
And they're weighing it.
They're weighing it. They're weighing it. Yep.
Yeah, interesting.
Yeah.
Fred, thank you so much for that call. Appreciate
good question.
It.
Yeah.
Yeah. Email from Lou says, is there a good area to watch for winter birds like there is in the spring at McGee Marsh?
Is there a good area to watch for winter birds? Well, yeah. The lake shores are always fabulous for gulls, for waterfowl, as long as there's a little bit of open water. One place that can be very productive would be like a hot water outflow from a power plant.
Hmm.
And that would be for waterfowl of all kinds, shorebirds sometimes, but geese, ducks, that kind of thing. And that's, you know, if you're really going birding. The other place I love to go in the winter for general birding is Amish country. And the reason that's so good is because the old-time farming practices, which include allowing hedgerows to remain, spilling some grain because you're not harvesting with, you know, the state-of-the-art equipment, leaving corn shocks for shelter, all that stuff creates havens for rodents and birds, and so you get raptors like snowy owls and short-eared owls and harriers and rough-legged hawks haunting the Amish fields. So that's another place I absolutely love to go is Amish country in the winter.
Email from Brenda. My dogs were sleeping peacefully on the floor while I worked. Then the birds started singing on the radio, and they jumped up to look for them. I guess just like cats should be inside, birds should be outdoors.
That's great.
Oh, that's great. Yeah. Have you seen those on television where cats sit in front of the television and watch birds?
Oh, yeah. And, you know, the odd dog will do that, like... Like, I remember when Chet was a puppy, he would watch the Westminster Dog Show with me, which was so awesome. He's like, oh, he really likes the Bichon Frise.
Yeah, right.
But usually dogs, if they can't corroborate, like, if they can't get an olfactory input as well as a visual, will lose interest very quickly.
Uh-huh.
Cats, though, are completely visual, so they will just, like, tune in on something and watch it.
And that's,
love that.
You know, for a homebound indoor cat, you know, that's something you can do for them, right? Leave some videos on when you go to work. And yeah.
Well, or have a feeder right outside the window so they can go, I love that thing they do when they can't, like, control their little lower lip.
Well, Julie Zicafus, the hour flew by. It's been a delight. Thank
Always.
You so much. I appreciate it.
Such fun. Let's talk any old time.
Okay. That's Julie Zicafus, naturalist, artist, author, and blogger. We'll have a link to her website, and you can read all of her wonderful blog posts. Thanks to everybody for your great questions. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.